In the 1990s, as genetic modification of food began to come into the public eye, our founder Maharshi warned strenuously against the dangers of this food. In fact, he went so far as to say that if you'd like to live a short life, then feel free to have a diet of this kind of food. There were people in our community who took this message from Maharshi very much to heart and changed not only their diet, but became spokespersons for the message of the warning against the dangers of genetically engineered food. And the foremost among those is our speaker tonight, Jeffrey Smith, who in the years since then has become a best-selling author. And I have a little bio here I'd like to read to you. Best-selling author and former NIH scientist Candace Pert describes Jeffrey Smith as the leading world expert in the understanding and communication of the health issues surrounding genetically modified food. Jeffrey's first book, Seeds of Deception, became the world's best-selling book on genetically modified organisms, or GMOs. It's been published in 10 languages and is credited with motivating changes in consumer buying habits and government policies. His newest book, Genetic Roulette, The Documented Health Risks of Genetically Modified Foods, presents 65 health dangers of the GM foods Americans eat every day. Former UK Environment Minister Michael Meacher says that the revelations in Genetic Roulette may, quote, change the global course of events in this century, unquote. Jeffrey has lectured in 22 countries and has been quoted by government leaders in hundreds of media outlets across the globe, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, the BBC, World Service, Nature magazine, New Scientist, and Time magazines. He's counseled world leaders on every continent. He's the founder and executive director of the Institute for Responsible Technology and the Campaign for Healthier Eating in America, which is designed to create a tipping point of consumer rejection of genetically modified foods to force them out of the market. Jeffrey holds a master's in business administration from Marsh University of Management and lives in Fairfield, Iowa. Jeffrey, we're really proud of all that you've done. We're proud that you're one of our own here in Fairfield, and thank you for coming and speaking with us this evening.
It's really great to be home. There we are. And to share with you the talk that I give around the world. And it always seemed odd that I haven't given my full presentation here. I also noticed there was an attitude in Fairfield. Yeah, we know GMOs are bad. Oh, yeah, and Jeffrey's doing a good job around, but we know GMOs are doing bad. And I watch people as they eat in restaurants, and they're eating GMOs. And they don't know which product is a GMO. And I may say to someone, so do you avoid GMOs? I say, oh, yeah, I try and buy organic whenever I can. And and they start listing some produce, some strawberries, and I say, well, there's no genetically modified strawberries. The carrot. There's no genetically modified carrots. I realized that this talk was long overdue, and I apologize for not coming here earlier to bring everyone up to speed. I wanted to ask you before we start, first of all, how many people here are farmers? How many are gardeners? Great. How many people eat? Almost everyone. Well, I want to tell you that I'm going to be bringing you on a journey tonight that gets really heavy. You know, disease, destruction, death. But we're going to come out the other side with a lot of optimism, because although genetically modified crops and foods are one of the greatest dangers we face as a planet, as an ecosystem, and as a race, they are one of the easiest of the major problems to deal with. In fact, I would perhaps say the easiest of the major problems. And the end is in sight. I can say that from being on the front lines. The end is in sight. And you will understand what that means. And what we're going to talk about is a tipping point. Now, this community is familiar with the concept that a small group of individuals can set the trends for the entire population. And this tipping point concept also happens in very classical terms. It happens in the case, for example, of the food system. And we're seeing a tipping point with genetically engineered bovine growth hormone. So we can turn this on now, Joel. Now, that's not this. How did that happen? There we go. Now let's keep the lights on here because I don't want to. Let's keep some lights on me here, please. Joel, there we go. Because you don't. I want to talk to you more than I want to show you slides. The tipping point of genetically modified bovine growth hormone started a few years ago because our organization and other organizations started to educate consumers about the link to cancer. You see, you take genes from cows and you put them into E. coli bacteria, turning the bacteria into a living factory, and then take that hormone produced by the factory. Oh, there we go. Okay, very good. Now that's better. So they take the hormone and they inject it into cows, which revs up the cows. It's called crack for cows, for those that know about it. And the milk has higher levels of pus, antibiotics, bovine growth hormone, and a hormone called IGF-1, insulin-like growth factor 1. Now, there's tons of studies showing that people with high levels of IGF-1 in their bodies have higher risks of cancer. Women below the age of 50 are 7 times more likely to develop breast cancer if they have high levels of IGF-1. Men are 4 times more likely to develop prostate cancer. It's implicated in lung and colon cancers, and it's in much higher levels in the milk from treated cows. So as we educate people about the health dangers, the market moves. And RBGH has been kicked out of Walmart, Starbucks, Yoplait, Danone, Kroger's, Publix, most of the major dairies so far. And we expect it to be kicked out completely. And this is a result of the power of the marketplace, and it's not most of Americans that are choosing non-GMO diets. It's a small percentage. Because, after all, a small percentage to the larger companies translates to millions of dollars and loss of goodwill. So we have a plan to create the tipping point of consumer rejection against genetically modified foods, and it's already underway. Last year, the fastest growing claim among store brands was GMO-free. In December, Supermarket News, the trade journal for the food industry, predicted that 2010 would see an unprecedented upsurge of consumer concern and awareness about GMOs, and credited our non-GMO shopping guide website as one of the 2 major reasons for this upsurge that they're expecting this year. Now, if we think, what percentage of the population do we need to create a tipping point? It's not probably square root of 1%. What percentage in terms of avoiding GM ingredients? Well, fortunately, genetically modified foods give no consumer benefit. So we think as little as 5% of U.S. shoppers, 15 million people, that's only 5.6 million households, avoiding genetically modified foods could create a tipping point to drive them out of the market. Now that's easy. 28 million Americans already buy organic regularly. 87 million think GMOs are unsafe. And the majority of Americans, 53%, say that avoid GMOs if given a choice. So all we have to do is to convey to people the health dangers of GMOs, how to avoid them, and let them know about the tipping point so they can also help spread the word. So our campaign for healthier eating in America is designed to do just that, to create a tipping point of consumer rejection in the United States. And we have targeted receptive demographic groups, and we have packaged materials to convey and pass on to those groups these 3 points: the health dangers, how to avoid GMOs, and the knowledge of the tipping point, so that those that would like to get on board can help us. And now what I'd want to do is ask you guys how vigilant you are at avoiding genetically modified foods in your life. And I want to ask you now before my talk and at the end to see how vigilant you plan to be next week, so we can test the power of the information that I'm about to give you. First, it's important to know which crops are genetically engineered. There's soy, corn, cotton, and canola, and there's also now sugar beets. So the sugar supply is genetically engineered, unless it says pure cane sugar. There's also Hawaiian papaya, most of it, and a little bit of zucchini and crookneck squash. And those are the only food crops that are genetically engineered. There's also the bovine growth hormone, which affects dairy. And, of course, there's animals that eat genetically modified crops, and also a substitute sweetener, aspartame, which is genetically engineered. So what I want you, in order to avoid GMOs, you have to either eat organic or buy products that say non-GMO or avoid the at-risk ingredients or buy products out of our new shopping guide, which is available as a handout. You can get a free one as you leave. It's also available on non-GMOshoppingguide.com, and it's available as an iPhone application, Shop No GMO. So now I'd like you to rate yourself from 1 to 100 how vigilant you've been in the last month avoiding genetically modified foods when going out to eat at restaurants. Assuming some of you actually go out to eat at restaurants. So this is more difficult. You've got to know what's in the ingredients. You've got to avoid the invisible at-risk ingredients like vegetable oils, soy, corn, cotton, and canola oils. So rate yourself from 1 to 100. 1 is low vigilance. 100 is high vigilance. Most people will be low vigilant. How many people here are in low vigilance? 1 to 20. Most people should raise their hand. 1 to 20. Don't feel shy. It's okay to admit it. Okay, 20 to 40. 40 to 60. 60 to 80. 80 to 100. Never go out to eat. All right. Now rate yourself from 1 to 100 how vigilant you are at avoiding brands that are genetically engineered foods. When you go out to eat, when you go out to buy foods, when you go to Everybody's or Hy-Vee or anywhere you buy foods, how vigilant are you at avoiding brands that contain GMOs? How many people are 1 to 20? 20 to 40? 40 to 60? 60 to 80? 80 to 100? Wow. Okay. Lots of vigilance here. So the pre- and post-test won't be so dramatic. All right. I'd like you to rate yourself from 1 to 100 how active you've been at educating people on this issue. Most people should be low. How many people are 1 to 20? 20 to 40? 40 to 60? 60 to 80? 80 to 100? All right. So now I'll begin my talk. The reason why genetically engineered foods are on our plates is because of a single sentence in the policy of the Food and Drug Administration, released in 1992. It claims that they're completely unaware of any differences between GMOs and non-GMOs. That they're not aware of any information showing that the foods are different, and on that basis, they said, we require no safety studies. We don't even have to be instructed and told by the companies that make the GMOs that they're going to introduce one to the marketplace. If they believe the foods are safe, they can introduce it to the market with no safety studies and without telling the FDA. Now, this policy turns out to be a lie. And that's a tactful way of saying it. A complete fictitious statement. We know because of a lawsuit that was pioneered by Stephen Drucker, who's sitting right here, Steve, the world owes you a debt of gratitude. You don't have to do anything else in your life. You can just put that on your resume and retire. You brought out 44,000 internal secret documents from the FDA, which showed that the actual scientists there, the overwhelming consensus among the scientists at the FDA were that GMOs were inherently dangerous and could create allergies, toxins, new diseases, and nutritional problems. They had urged their superiors to require long-term studies. So what happened? Who ignored the science? Who ignored the scientists? Well, the person in charge of policy at the FDA at the time was Michael Taylor, Monsanto's former attorney. Monsanto's the big biotech company. He later became Monsanto's vice president, and he was now appointed by the Obama administration as the U.S. food safety czar. I wrote a blog on Huffington Post saying, it is amazing that the person who is probably responsible for more food-related illnesses and deaths in human history is in charge of the safety of the U.S. food supply. You see, the first Bush administration told the FDA, promote biotechnology because it'll increase U.S. exports. The opposite happened, nonetheless. And so they created a new position for Michael Taylor. And according to Stephen Drucker, who I quote all over the world, as the policy draft was reviewed and renewed, in each subsequent draft, the concerns of the scientists were skillfully removed more and more. Till one FDA scientist said, what's become of this document? It's no science, it's basically a political document and doesn't address the side effects. But that is the official position of the United States, that there is no difference. And it's a political science, but it's not real science. The first crop that participated in the voluntary consultation process with the FDA was the Flavor Saver tomato. And it was designed for longer shelf life. It's no longer on the shelf, so it didn't work. But it was introduced in 1994. But before it was introduced, it was the only company that actually gave raw feeding study data to the FDA to look at. And a very interesting thing happened. For their rat study, the rats refused to eat the tomato. Let's hear it for those rats. I think they blew a fantastic marketing opportunity for rat-proof tomatoes, personally. You know, it's not just rats that have this uncanny ability to know what to stay alive. That all over the United States and around the world, when given a choice, animals exhibit the strange behavior of avoiding GMOs. Pigs, cows, geese, elk, deer, raccoons, squirrels, mice, rats, chickens, and buffalo. So it's our job to get humans up to the level of animals. In my book, Seeds of Deception, before every chapter, I write a little wisdom of the animal blurb about one of these scenarios where the animals avoided GMOs. And one of them was with squirrels. And so one of the, a farmer in Illinois decided he wanted to test it. So he bought a bag of GM corn and bought a bag of non-GM corn cobs and put it in his garage to wait for winter to see if he could do this experiment. But when he went to collect the bags, the mice had done the experiment for him. They ate all of the non-GMO corn and left the GM corn untouched. So getting back to our tomato-eating mice, or non-eating mice, they force-fed the mice the tomatoes, and 7 of 20 developed stomach lesions, and 7 of 40 died within 2 weeks. The political appointees did not raise a red flag, even though the scientists said this does not meet our traditional standard of reasonable certainty of no harm. Now, in the UK, there was a very pro-GM government under Tony Blair, and he wanted to prove to the skeptical public that GMOs were safe. And so they decided to do actual long-term animal feeding studies. They put out a grant saying, who can tell us how to tell if GMOs are safe? And they had 28 applicants, and they gave the grant to one person, Dr. Arpad Pusztai, the world's leading expert in his field. And he led a team of about 20 or 30 people in 3 different institutes to create the protocol that was to be instituted in the EU regulations for all safety assessments for GMOs. And as part of his process, they created a potato. It was intended to go on the market. And it was a potato where they took a gene from the snowdrop plant and put it into the potato so the potato produced its own pesticide. And as part of the protocols, they gave the GM potato along with a complete and balanced diet to a group of rats. To another group of rats, they gave natural potatoes. And to a third group, they gave natural potatoes, plus it was spiked with the same insecticide that the GM potatoes produced. So GM potato, non-GM potato, non-GM potato plus insecticide. But only the GM group got sick. What was the cause of the problem? It was not the insecticide. Somehow it was the process of genetically engineering the potato that caused potentially precancerous cell growth in the digestive tract, smaller brains, livers, and testicles, partial atrophy of the liver, damaged immune system in 10 days. Here's a picture of the intestinal walls on the right of the rats that were fed the GM potato. The difference is more easily seen in the stomach lining. Dr. Pusztai was invited to speak on television about GMOs around the time that these data were being presented to him. And with permission from his director, he was interviewed. The show aired for 2.5 minutes, and he was a hero at his prestigious institute for 2 days. At the end of the second day, 2 phone calls were allegedly placed from the UK Prime Minister's office, forwarded through the receptionist to the director. The next morning, Dr. Pusztai was fired from his job after 35 years. He was silenced with threats of a lawsuit. The 20-member research team was disbanded. They never implemented the protocols. Instead, both the government and his former institute embarked on a campaign to destroy his reputation in order to protect the reputation of genetic engineering. After 7 months, by an order of Parliament, he was able to speak. The documents were published, and it remains the most in-depth animal feeding study yet conducted on genetically modified foods. Now, I asked Dr. Pusztai, what was your most shocking moment? Can you guess why I asked that question? Because I was writing a book. Because I was looking for shocking moments. And I got quite a number. I got the UC Berkeley professor telling me that a senior Mexican government official threatened him, implying, "We know where your children go to school," trying to get him not to publish evidence of contamination by GM corn into the indigenous corn varieties in Mexico. I got Fox reporters telling me how they were fired because they refused to lie on television and they wanted to talk about the link to cancer between genetically engineered bovine growth hormone and the milk that people are drinking. I got the fact that the FDA withheld information from Congress about a deadly epidemic in the United States that killed about 100 people, caused 5,000 to 10,000 to fall sick, and they did not tell Congress about the genetically engineered origins of the epidemic. So when I asked Dr. Pusztai what was the most shocking moment, I was expecting it to be the moment he was fired or the moment he discovered the dangers to the rats. But I was wrong. He told me something he hadn't told any of the other interviewers, the hundreds of interviews he had done, because no one asked him that question. His most shocking moment was months before this whole incident. He was still a pro-GM scientist in good standing. Professor Philip James, the director, walked into his office and presented a stack of about 600 to 700 pages and said, "These are the submissions from 6 or 7 biotech companies to get their products approved in the UK. And the Minister of Agriculture is meeting in Brussels to vote on GMOs and wants a scientific opinion." Now, the reason why the director had these confidential documents was because he was a member of the 12-member committee that approved GMOs for the UK. Now, Dr. Pusztai told me, he said, "I looked at the stack, I looked at Philip James, I looked back at the stack, and I realized this man would never read these many pages. Nor would the other 11 members of the committee. They were committee men, very busy. They were not working scientists." He, on the other hand, had spent the previous 2 years developing a protocol for how to tell if GMOs are safe. He was among the most qualified humans on Earth to evaluate the stack. He said, "How much time do we have?" The professor said, 2.5 hours. Arpad said to me, "Jeffrey, That was a turning point in my life. I realized what I was doing and what they were doing was diametrically opposed. I was doing safety studies. They were doing as little as possible to get their foods on the market as quickly as possible. He said it was flimsy, superficial, bad science, poor science. He said, it's just, you know, bad science. And this was clearly bad science. He called up the minister and said, I wasn't planning to give you a strong recommendation after just 2.5 hours. But I have to say, there's definitely not enough information in these documents to allow these foods on the market and fed to human beings. The minister said, I don't know why you're telling me that. Those foods were approved 2 years ago. They're already on the market. They didn't want ARPOD to give information about approval. They just wanted a scientific opinion from someone who actually read the submissions. So soon after, when ARPOD realized the damage that had occurred to his rats by the potatoes, he realized that the potatoes, if they had been tested in the same superficial way that the industry had tested it, soy and corn and tomatoes, the potatoes would have made it to the market without a problem. Because they didn't look at the precancerous cell growth. They didn't weigh the organs. They didn't look at the immune system. They did hardly anything. But what was of greater concern to Pustai was the fact that the soy and corn and tomatoes on the market were created from the same process that he used to create the potatoes. Remember, it was not the insecticide that caused the problem. It was somehow the process. So these results may be happening inside our bodies by the GM crops on the market, and no one knows because no one has still, to this day, tested the current GM crops to the extent that ARPOD Pustai did with potatoes in 1998. Now, what I just did is I used stories to talk about the dangers of GMOs. And that was the plan for Seeds of Deception, and it worked. It became the world's best-selling book based on the X-Files of GMOs, the dark underbelly, as one reviewer put it. But as I gave this book, as I traveled around the world, now it's been 32 countries, and I gave this, I was traveling around about 25 countries at a certain point, and I'd give this book out to senior political leaders. And as I handed it to them, my thought was, they'll never read this. Because it's all the information is hidden inside the story. And these guys are very busy, like Professor Philip James. They would never read the stack of papers. Now, I did get lucky in Vermont. A co-op gave a copy of the book to every legislator, and a master's degree student did a thesis on the impact of my book on the first state regulation on GMOs, which was passed in Vermont. And one legislator said, Seeds of Deception spread like wildfire and was the basis of every conversation on GMOs once it arrived in the State House. And so it changed his vote and many people's votes, and it did have an effect there. But it's rare. And so I realized I needed to get information out to the politician that has about attention span like this. But I also knew by this time that I could beat any scientist in a debate on the safety of GMOs and had information I wanted to convey to policymakers who were looking at the actual details. And so they needed a textbook, and the policymakers needed a brochure. So I got textbook, brochure. It's like the Saturday Night Live skit. It's a dessert topping. No, it's a floor wax. You're both right, ladies. It's the best floor wax you've ever eaten. So what I decided to do was to create 2-in-1. With a 2-page spread. This side is for the attention deficit politician. And this side is for the staff. This side is the conclusion, bullet points, and a quote. And this side is the reference text. So every 65 2-page spreads can allow someone to do a quick scan or a casual read or an in-depth study. And I highlight all the different health dangers, both the adverse findings and the theoretical risks. Thousands of sick, sterile, and dead livestock, thousands of toxic and allergic reactions in humans, damage to virtually every organ and every system studied. And I figured if I gave this to my senator, which I did later, what could he do to get out of having to deal with another problem? He could say, well, I'm sure that the FDA is aware of all this. and are doing a good job to protect the public. So the next part, which I draw heavily on Steve Drucker's information, shows how the FDA and regulators around the world are not competent to even identify most of the 65 risks in the first part. Then one of my favorite sections is part three, how I show that industry rigs its research to avoid finding problems. Like Monsanto scientists in documents that were stolen from the FDA files and later made public, when they wanted to show that injections of bovine growth hormone didn't interfere with fertility in cows, they apparently secretly added cows to the study that were already pregnant before they got injected. Or to show that the hormone was destroyed during pasteurization, they over-pasteurized the milk 120 times longer than normal. That only destroyed 19% of the hormone, so they added powdered hormone to the milk. Huge quantities, 147 times the natural occurring level. 147 times the amount of natural occurring hormone, heated 120 times longer than normal, destroyed 90% of the hormone. What do you think the FDA reported? 90% of the hormone is destroyed as a result of pasteurization. Never pointing out all these rigged research. There's another one I love in here where Monsanto was trying to get their high lysine corn approved in Australia. And they said, the protein produced by the inserted gene is in the soil anyway, and so it has a history of safe use in our diet because we eat soil residues, right? So it's no problem if we just have a little more in the corn. So a friend of mine did an analysis and figured, what's the average level of corn eaten by a U.S. male? And if that were all of the high lysine corn, how much soil would he have to consume in order to have an equivalent amount? 24,000 pounds per second. They were several trillion times off. And they use all sorts of other bizarre techniques, and it's fun. It's one of my funnest parts of the book. It's just like detective work, and it just blatantly shows the lies. And finally, I had to do a part that shows that GMOs actually work against feeding the hungry world, and they take away money from better things, and they cause all sorts of problems. So this became the policy book, and the policy book basically talks to the science, and it divides the problems into categories, and what I want to share with you now are five categories. So I'm going to switch gears from the storytelling to the science, but I'll make it easy to understand. These are the things that can go wrong or have gone wrong with GMOs. And the first category is what we already discussed, the process itself. The process itself causes massive collateral damage in the DNA of the plant. What you do, let's say you want to create a pesticide-producing corn. So you take a gene from the bacteria in the soil called Bacillus thuringiensis, or BT for short. You take the gene which produces the insect-killing poison, and you make millions of copies. Okay, but before you do that, you add a viral promoter, a promoter from the virus. A promoter is the on switch. It turns on the gene 24/7 around the clock at high volume. Then you put an end switch at the back, saying a stop signal, which says, stop reading, the gene ends here. So you make that genetic cassette. Millions of times, you build up millions of them, put it into a gun, and shoot that gun into a plate of millions of cells, hoping that some of those genes will make it into the DNA of some of those cells. But you don't know where it lands in the cell, and if it gets into the DNA, where it lands in the DNA. So what they do is, before they shoot it in, they add another gene called an antibiotic-resistant marker gene, where if it gets into the cell and into the place in the DNA so it's functioning, it'll render the cell invincible to a class of antibiotics. So they douse the cell with antibiotics, killing almost all the cells, except the very few that got the gene inserted into the DNA. Then they clone those into a plant. And now the corn plant has a little spray bottle in every cell producing a toxin to kill insects. Now, the process of insertion, whether it's from gene gun or bacterial infection, plus cloning, causes changes, hundreds or thousands of mutations up and down the DNA. It's 2 to 4% different than a natural plant. Genes can be deleted, turned off, permanently turned on. And in a study that surprised everyone, that no one pays attention to, they found that up to 5% of the natural genes in a cell can change their levels of protein expression when a single foreign gene is inserted. In other words, it freaks out. So that means that as much as 1,000 cells, 1,000 genes or more, can be changing their levels of expression. Now, when they change their levels of expression or have mutations, these are Monsanto's corn pictures, that means that it can change the amount of RNA it produces, the amount of protein, and all those compounds, hundreds or thousands of compounds that exist in the plant. You can have higher levels of existing compounds like allergens or toxins or carcinogens or anti-nutrients or completely new ones that have never before been in the plant. Now, the second cause of problems, and by the way, they don't actually check for all those changes. They don't look for them, which is one of the big problems. The second cause is that the gene that is inserted into the crop is designed to produce a particular protein. That protein, which is intended to be in the plant, may be dangerous. Now, there's two major traits for nearly all GM crops planted. Either they're poison drinkers or poison producers. We talked about the poison producer, the BT. They produce a toxin that kills every insect, certain insects that bite them. And there's two types of BT crops, corn and cotton. The soy, corn, cotton, canola, and sugar beets also have varieties that drink poison. You see, Monsanto scientists found bacteria growing in a chemical waste dump near their factory, and it was growing in the presence of Roundup herbicide, which normally kills bacteria. And they said, great, let's put it in the food supply. So they took the gene that allowed the cells to survive the Roundup, and they put it into these crops. So now you have Roundup-ready soybeans that don't die when sprayed with Roundup herbicide. And so that's 85% of all GM crops. They're sold as a package, herbicide and seed that tolerates the herbicide. Now, let's take a look at the BT toxin in the corn and cotton and see if it has a problem for human consumption. Now, the EPA, which is in charge of these plants registered as pesticides, they say that BT has a history of safe use, so it's safe. You see, you can actually use the soil bacteria itself and gather it up and put it in the spray and spray it on plants and kill insects. And even organic farmers do it. It biodegrades in the sunlight, it washes off in the rain, it's gone within a couple of weeks. And it's part of our forestry service also. They use it for gypsy moths. So they say it's been used before, we can put it right in the food supply without a problem. They also assume that it's destroyed in the digestive process for humans or mammals and that there's no receptor cells in humans or mammals, and so it's completely benign even if it weren't digested. So on the basis of these assumptions, they say, you don't have to test BT crops, let them eat poison. Now, it turns out that in reality, people do react to this BT spray. When it was used for gypsy moth infestation in the Pacific Northwest, about 500 people reported allergic symptoms or flu-like symptoms. Some had to go to the hospital. When they fed BT to mice, it survived digestion, damaged their intestines, and elicited a powerful immune response. They even became sensitive to other formerly harmless foods. So they became generally sensitive or allergenic. But the BT in the crops is thousands of times more concentrated than the spray form. It's designed to be more toxic than the spray form. It even has a property of a known allergen. And it doesn't wash off. When they fed mice BT corn, they had massive immune responses. This was an Italian government study. When the Austrian government fed a combination of BT and Roundup ready corn in the same cell to mice, the more corn they fed, the fewer babies the mice had and the smaller the babies were. In Monsanto's own rat studies that were made public from lawsuits or leaked by governments to independent investigators, they found evidence of toxicity in the liver and kidneys, as well as immune responses, and all sorts of indications of high blood pressure problems and a whole slew of other things that Monsanto's scientists ignored and said, there's no problem with this corn. This corn is already on the market. Now, thousands of laborers in India who pick the BT cotton are reporting allergic reactions. They're showing rashes all over their bodies, eruptions, itching constantly. According to the Sunday Indian, victims of itching have increased massively this year related to BT cotton farming. That's according to hospital records. And the pharmacy manager said almost every cotton worker from this village suffers from itching. When I wrote Genetic Roulette, I went back through all of the different 65 risks and I looked for connecting patterns. And I wrote a section called Connecting the Dots. And there, at that point, I realized that the symptoms described by the 500 people in the Pacific Northwest when they were sprayed with BT are identical to the symptoms described by doctors who investigated the reactions among the Indian farm workers, suggesting that the BT is causing the problem in both cases. Now, after you pick the cotton in India, in many regions they allow animals to graze on the cotton plants, and thousands of sheep died very quickly after eating the BT cotton plants. They also had skin problems, upper respiratory problems. And one of the organizations that hosted me in India last year, Deccan Development Society, tried to get the government to do studies on the sheep. The government said no. They tried to get universities to do studies on the sheep. The DDS even offered to pay for the study, but no one would do it. So they did their own little study. They tied some sheep in a area where there was just non-BT cotton, then Bolgard 1 cotton, then Bolgard 2 cotton. And within a month, the sheep that were eating Bolgard 1 and Bolgard 2 had all died. And those that ate non-GM cotton were fine. In fact, I met them last year. They were doing fine. So they released their report, and the people said, well, it wasn't a government study, it wasn't a university study, so they ignored it. I got an email from India, state of Haryana, saying that someone was just shocked. He went around and found that buffalo were dying in large numbers and having all sorts of problems, reproductive problems, problems with productions of milk, skin problems, their calves were dying. So I connected that person and some other people together and got some money together and we sent a team of investigators, a reporter, two veterinarians, a project leader, and a film crew. And they spent time interviewing these people, and sure enough, these things were happening throughout the state. And then I visited a village where they had allowed their buffalo to graze on cotton plants for years without problem, but on January 3rd, 2008, they allowed all their buffalo to graze on the BT cotton plants for the first time for one day. And all 13 died within 3 days. They also did a post-mortem and found holes in the lungs. The liver was drier and flattened and dry. Then they found undigested food in the rumen. Now, at this point, a week earlier, I had a meeting with one of the renowned scientists of India, Dr. P.M. Bhargava. And Dr. Bhargava was asked by the Supreme Court of India to become part of the Genetic Engineering Approval Committee as a guest to evaluate how it approved GMOs for India, because there was a citizen's petition claiming fraud and asking for moratorium. So Dr. Bhargava spent 10 months evaluating the GEAC, and then in December, 2 years ago, wrote to the Supreme Court, the Prime Minister, and the Health Minister saying, yes, there should be a moratorium. Not a single GM crop in the world has been properly evaluated. That they don't even read the submissions. That sounds familiar, right, at this point? They read the proper submissions in the Indian GEAC. And that of the 29 categories of things that should be tested, only 10% are tested, but they're done by industry so poorly that they're worthless. And I loved meeting with this man, because I interviewed him for about 3 hours, and he had concluded on his own. He said he reads 600 scientific journals. He goes through to see and he was studying GMOs as part of that. And he came to the same conclusions that I had come to working with 30 scientists for Genetic Roulette. And he said it would be very interesting to see in 10 or 20 years to see if GMOs are the reason for the increase in the deteriorating health in the United States and Canada, which he thinks may in fact be the reason. And one thing that he said that I had never heard before. He said, you know, with the sheep, maybe the BT is killing the microorganisms in the rumen of the sheep, which breaks down the cellulose in the early part of the digestion. And so it never gets to the intestines. That's why the sheep had shriveled intestines. So here, I looked at it and said, there was undigested food in the rumen of buffalo 4 days after they died. I called him up in Delhi. He had just met with the GAC. And I said, good news, I just found undigested food in the rumen of buffalo. And he said, see, I told you. He didn't get excited. He's 81 years old. 25 of his close friends and former students have Nobel Prizes. So he wasn't excited. But I was. I asked the people who I interviewed in this place, how many of you personally have got reactions, itching reactions from working in BT fields? And most people raised their hand. They also told me quite casually that 26 of their sheep and goats also died from eating BT cotton plants. Now, in Germany, one farmer says that after feeding exclusively a certain variety of BT corn, 12 of his cows died, many more got sick. There's about 24 farmers in the U.S. that say their pigs or cows became sterile. Some gave birth to bags of water. And in the Philippines, by inhaling the BT pollen, virtually an entire village suffered skin, respiratory, and intestinal reactions and fever. That's what they say. The same seeds were planted in 4 more villages the following year. The same symptoms returned, but only during the time of pollination. They also said that there were deaths among horses, buffaloes, and chickens, as well as unexplained human deaths. Now, the third reason for problems is that the gene that's producing the protein that you intend may actually produce something very different than what you intend. And there's reasons for that. When you insert the transgene, it has a code, and it's transcribed into RNA, then translated into amino acids. So every 3 pieces of the code become 1 amino acid, and you get the sequence of the amino acids. But during the process of insertion, the transgene code can get scrambled or truncated. Like Monsanto's corn variety, Mon-A10, 30% of it got cut off. The stop signal, which says stop reading, the gene ends here, got cut off. So when it produces amino acids, it continues to produce beyond the transgene and starts coding from the plant's own DNA, creating a protein that's never existed in nature that was never intended. Also, laboratories in Europe decided to actually sequence the transgene in popular GM crops, 6 of them, and found that all 6, the actual sequence, differed from the sequence that had been registered by the companies. And some of them, tested by different labs, had different sequences in the same variety, suggesting that not only are they disrupted upon insertion, but they're unstable, changing spontaneously on their own over time, meaning that the protein that's produced today in Fairfield's crops out there may be different than the one that's produced in Indiana last year, etc. How could you do a safety assessment on such a moving target? Also, even if the transgene is put intact, it could be created, read differently, or produce multiple proteins. Even if the amino acid sequence is accurately the same as what you intended, the protein can be folded up differently or have molecular attachments that can change a harmless protein into a deadly one in a new environment where that gene and protein have never before existed. And that apparently is what's happened in Australia with genetically modified peas that were about to go to the market. These peas had already passed all the safety studies, all the superficial, flimsy, bad science, poor quality safety studies that normally are done before a crop goes on the market. But the crop developers decided to do one more study that no other GM food crop developer had done before or since. They took the gene, the protein that had been produced by the gene in its natural state, in a pinto bean, and exposed it to mice, and the mice had no problem. The protein was safe. They looked at the protein that was being produced in the peas from the borrowed gene from the pinto. So they took the gene from the pintos, put it in the peas, they produced, quote, the identical protein, same amino acid sequence, gave it to the mice, inflammatory reactions, like asthma and other things that suggest that the peas protein had now become deadly, could create anaphylactic shock and kill people. And this surprised them because it was an identical protein. So they did another study, which almost no one ever does in GM crops, and found, oh, the way that the sugar chains attach themselves to the protein, some slight, subtle difference. What a surprise. For such closely related species, who would have guessed? When Monsanto's representative in Europe was asked about this, he said, well, this shows that the approval process works because the peas were canceled.